You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, from Germany and Turkey to China and Guantanamo Bay, we'll review the day's top news stories with Raffaello Pantucci and Quentin Peel. Then we're in Hong Kong to review the Chinese weekly papers. Patrick Bowler looks at local coverage of the protests in Hong Kong.
The mainland media reports on the protests in Hong Kong were all, they were strictly following the party lines. There's no in-depth reporting on what motivated the protesters in Hong Kong. It just wouldn't be allowed.
Thor Bjørgolfsson is Iceland's first billionaire, and he's just written a book about his experiences, Billions to Bust and Back. He tells us about the challenges of doing business in Russia in the late 90s, where he made his money.
Russia would change on an instant. The currency might fall 25% in a day. You know, the whole electricity would go off the block for 2 days. It was just an endless array of small problems.
And later in the show... Nick Luscombe will be here in the studio for a rundown of his favourite music tracks of the week. That's all to come right here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, rather a lot to pack into the next hour, but first, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
There have been further sharp falls in oil prices to levels that haven't been seen in the last 5 years. Brent crude dropped to just over $51 a barrel before recovering a little. In the US, crude oil prices fell far below $50 for the first time in nearly 6 years. Global markets have also been hit by concerns over a possible Greek exit from the Eurozone. A left-wing party, poised to do well in a snap election later this month, could try to wipe out Greece's huge debts. That could force it out of Europe's single currency. Analyst Jeremy Stretch says that would be unprecedented.
I think we have this twin problem that we have to be concerned as to the ability to withstand any contagion risk, and more so I think the possibility that one member leaving breaks that irrevocable nature of the Eurozone. And of course, then that does potentially open the floodgates for others, should they also run into difficulties over time.
A suicide bomber has blown herself up inside a police station in Istanbul, killing one officer and injuring another. The attack happened in an area popular with tourists close to the Blue Mosque. It comes less than a week after a far-left group said it was behind a grenade attack on police near the Prime Minister's office in the city. Pakistan's parliament has passed a law to set up military courts to try terror suspects. It's part of a crackdown on insurgents after last month's attack at a school in Peshawar, in which more than 150 people died, the vast majority of them children. Critics have questioned whether there'll be any civilian supervision of the courts, and have asked why the army's powers are being expanded in a country where the military has seized power in the past. But Pakistan's interior minister has said the courts will have a limited mandate and won't try civilians. A Palestinian man has been given a life prison sentence for the abduction and murder of three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. Hussam Kasame, who's a member of Hamas, was involved in the murders, which led to a spike in violence in the region, later triggering a 50-day conflict in Gaza. Two other suspects were shot dead by Israeli forces last September. A new term in the US Congress begins today, with Republicans in control of both chambers for the first time in 8 years. The party won a majority in the Senate during last November's midterm elections. Key issues include a vote to approve a controversial oil pipeline, which is likely within days, and a challenge to President Obama's health care reforms. Former political leaders in Germany have joined sports stars and other celebrities in a campaign against what they say is an alarming surge in xenophobia. They've signed a statement opposing anti-immigration rallies staged in the country over the last 3 months. On Monday, 18,000 people attended one rally in Dresden, but there have been a series of counter-demonstrations as well. A solar-powered plane has set off from Switzerland towards Abu Dhabi at the start of an attempt to fly around the world. The two-person crew of the Solar Impulse 2 will have to cope with extreme temperatures and highly restricted movements inside the cockpit. The plane's solar panels provide enough energy to keep it in the air for up to 5 days at a time. Co-pilot Bertrand Piccard says it's a chance to find a cleaner way to travel.
We would like to demonstrate with Solar Impulse that we can today achieve incredible things with renewable energies and clean technologies. If an airplane can fly with no fuel around the world, can you imagine how these technologies could be used everywhere? We have today solutions, technical solutions, to divide by two the energy consumption of the world.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. My guests today are Quentin Peel, Senior Fellow at Chatham House, and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at RUSI. Quentin and Raffaello, welcome both to the programme. Let's begin with the anti-Islam protests in Germany, which have been taking place on a weekly basis since October. As we just heard in the news, roughly 18,000 people took part in a demonstration in Dresden on Monday. However, counter-protests have now also sprung up. Quentin, Raffaello, I'll get your opinions in just a moment. But first, let's hear from Imke Henkel, Zeit Online's London correspondent. On today's briefing, she explained to Robert Bound the origins of the anti-Islam movement.
It stands for European Patriots Against Islamization of the West, which is actually, in German, it's the word Abendland, which is far more politically, conservatively loaded than the English word West. So it is a conservative, definitely partly a neo-Nazi, definitely partly racist movement against foreigners. But as the word partly says, that is only part of it. So all kind of different emotions, moods, political thinking comes into it. And actually, I just read a very clever article this morning trying to bring together what explanations you have. Germany is a funny country in the moment because you had all kinds of polls showing that most Germans are eerily content because it seems so frightening almost. Yeah. So there's 60% to 70% to 80% happy, but seem to be in polls, happy to be the economy, with the government, with Merkel and everything. And you always felt that can't be quite true. And Pegida seems to be part of it that comes up that is not quite true.
Eerily content, there's a phrase. That was Imke Henkel from Zeit Online talking to us a bit earlier. Quentin, one of the things that strikes me about this movement and the response to it is that whilst in other European countries, a lot of mainstream politicians have tried to either pander to anti-immigrant sentiment or at least sort of couch their language as, well, we understand where you're coming from. Angela Merkel and most of the German political establishment have been incredibly firm in their opposition to this, haven't they?
Yeah, I think it's been very striking. It says a lot about what Germany is determined not to be. But it is surprising somebody like Angela Merkel, who is not notorious for taking very firm, clear positions, came out so strongly in her New Year's address saying, you know, basically this is racism. And I've been asking German friends whether they think that's dangerous on her part. Is she actually, you know, in danger of getting on the wrong side of the debate? And they said, no, this is actually, I mean, it looks surprising, but it's quite isolated. This is very much Dresden. That's really the centre of it. That's former East Germany. It's not one of the worst parts of former East Germany, but nonetheless, it's a bit miserable. It's a bit feeling left behind, and it has a tiny proportion of immigrants and places where many more immigrants are not out on the streets.
And Raffaello, it's interesting that it's, you know, as Quentin says there, it's a place where actually there aren't many immigrants. And if you look at where there is anti-immigration sentiment across Europe, it always tends to be in the place where, you know, certainly here in England, it's, you know, it's in parts of the country where there are simply no migrants whatsoever. It's almost impossible to find any. Why is it that we're finding this sentiment cropping up in places where they have arguably the least to fear?
Well, I mean, it's the classic, the situation isn't great there, so you find someone to blame. And who's easy to blame? Well, it's the stranger, the foreigners, you know. So that kind of pointing fingers in that direction is something that, you know, makes sense. And I think we've seen in lots of other contexts. It is fascinating in the UK to look at the places where UKIP does very well, some of which are the places where there really are the fewest migrants in this whole country. I think that's true across Europe. I think what's most interesting about this whole conversation in Germany, I think, is the fact that the sort of political mainstream has completely rejected it, you know, completely said, no, this is absolutely nothing that we want anything to do with. Whereas if we look at other European contexts, there is a definite sense that having these sorts of parties stoking these xenophobic sentiments and sort of is actually pulling the whole center of gravity in some countries in a slightly rightward direction, which is quite worrying and I think quite disturbing. Because at the end of the day, it's really, you know, people's reactions to these sorts of things, to fear of immigrants, is really about perceptions and it's really about senses. It's often not really grounded in any real empirical fact.
And Quentin, in Germany, it's not just the political establishment. You're seeing, you on the front page of Bild, the biggest tabloid, there was a big front page saying, you know, how terrible this was. You've seen cathedrals saying they're going to turn off their lights so that the protesters don't have this sort of beautifully illuminated shot. And then, of course, as we're hearing in the news, there's, you know, sports stars now coming out. What impact do you think that will have on either these demonstrations or the possibility that this can spread into a broader movement?
I think that the resistance, if you like, to an anti-immigration agenda is very strong in Germany, precisely because of German history, because of the Nazis, because of memories of that sort of world. And that goes very deep. And it's, as you say, it's in the churches. It was so striking to watch the pictures of all the lights going out in Cologne Cathedral, just bang like that. So I think that's important. And yet it's a quite stark contrast. I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I first went as a correspondent to Germany. I was in Bonn. And if you like, Germany was almost hideously white, as somebody famously said. I mean, the football team was white, the athletics teams were all white. A lot of that has changed in the last 25 years, and it's remarkable to me that, at least until this point, how relatively calmly German people have taken this transformation. Part of it is that a lot of the immigrants are coming from Central and Eastern Europe, precisely the immigrants who seem to be causing problems for the British and not causing problems in Germany. It's an interesting
contrast. And is it, Quentin, sorry, just on this point, is it also partly been less of a social issue in Germany because the economy on the whole has been strong over the past decade, in the sense that if you look at lots of other European countries where this sentiment is stronger, that hasn't been the case?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, youth unemployment is marginal in Germany, particularly in southern Germany. And this is why it is in eastern Germany that the problem has blown up, because that's where the highest unemployment is.
I suppose in some ways these sorts of these protests have highlighted the places in Germany where there wasn't such economic success, where, you know, Germany seen as the great economic motor and successful vehicle in Europe. The reality is it isn't a uniform picture. There are some parts of the country, particularly in the East, that are still quite underdeveloped.
Yeah. But Germany's got to come to terms with being now a country of immigrants. It's now got the largest proportion of immigrants of any country in Europe.
And is it able to come to terms with that? Or is it that's still a debate it's yet to have properly?
Well, I think it is. And it's interesting. I mean, they changed the nationality laws a decade ago. This was the Social Democrats and the Greens who changed the laws so that you now can become a German just by living there, rather than that you had to have German blood. And that was a very important moment.
So you'd had generations of these Gastarbeiters, that particularly Turkish, who'd come to Germany but weren't seen as citizens.
Yeah, they were seen as, you know, they're going to go home.
Or even their children were in some cases born, and because the parents weren't German citizens, and even if they were born in Germany, they followed the parents' passports and ended up with Turkish passports and weren't really considered German citizens, even though they had been born in the country and essentially been brought up there.
Yeah, that's right. And so now they have the choice. They may still have to make that choice. They haven't quite got to the point of having a dual citizenship for those Turks.
We'll move on to in a moment to other German issues. But Raffaello, looking more broadly on this issue, is there a limit across Europe to how many people will have these sorts of feelings? Because it's, for all the noise that is made in certainly the UK with UKIP or in certain parts, for example, in Sweden with the Sweden Democrats, there is still 80 to 85% of the population that is voting for other people, that is rejecting this form of politics. Mm-hmm. Is there a level at which this stops?
I think it varies across Europe. I think in some of the larger Western European countries, it probably does remain a marginal feature. But I think if you look at some of the other countries like Austria, for example, you could see a country that at one point voted in a government that was really quite nasty and got itself almost booted out of the European... Well, I can't remember the exact process, but there was definitely a moment at which the Austrians were told, essentially, you have to change your government or, you're going to have issues with your membership of the European Union. And so I think there you clearly have a larger a larger body in the general population who sort of seem to leave in these sorts of directions. But I think if you look at the sort of other larger European countries, in some ways what's more worrying, or I find more disturbing, is the fact that you're seeing the mainstream parties are reacting to the emergence of these parties mostly on the far right by not sort of excluding them or rejecting them, but instead sort of being dragged in their direction a bit. And I think that's the thing that I find most worrying, especially when you look at France and the Front National and their sort of growth and success, and even what UKIP's done to the sort of Tories here.
I think there is a particular issue here. I mean, these demonstrations in Germany are specifically focused on what they call Islamization. Mm. And it is the issue of Islam in there, which seems to make it, because of the whole worry about terrorism and so on, somehow more acceptable to say, here is a particular sector of society that is refusing to integrate, therefore we're justified in being hostile to them. Mm. I think it's a very dangerous move, but it is one that is, I think, in common to quite a few of our countries, that it is actually the problems of Islam.
Okay, let's move on now to we'll sort of stay with Germany. Angela Merkel is visiting London this week. British politicians across the spectrum will be hoping to meet her, to see what the secret is for how you can be a successful centrist politician. And Quentin Peele, she comes here. A year after she came here the last time, almost with an even better reputation now, given the way that she's dealt with the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
It's extraordinary that she's riding very high. And this is a woman who doesn't have many of the attributes you'd expect of a sort of in-your-face television age, internet age politician. Mind, she's a great texter by mobile phone. She loves that.
And that's why the NSA was listening to her phone, right?
But not a great speaker. And
no, she always makes the same speeches. She sticks to the same policies. She repeats herself. And but she's what German voters like, because she's reassuring. She's not worrying. And she seems to be what rather a lot of European voters like. She's sort of... she's not edgy. She's reassuring. She's got a sense of humour, which is fun. She's not boring. She's actually quite fun.
Well, here's the thing, Raffaello. Is she... She may be the sort of politician that other politicians want to be and that may be quite appealing to Germany right now as a stateswoman. Mm. However, to get elected in the first place, do you need to be a bit more of a rabble-rouser, a bit more of an orator, a bit more of a sort of a man or woman of the people than perhaps, Angela Merkel might be?
Well, I think her running again, she's got a long, successful track record to run on. So she can sort of move on that. So she can continue to project this sort of stable as a table, kind of perspective. And that will serve her quite well. I think for other politicians, yes, you do need a bit of, you need a bit of pizzazz these days to sort of attract attention and attract votes. Because if you don't, frankly, someone else will. You need to look at the United Kingdom and see how moribund, the sort of Labour Party, is partially because their leader has demonstrated a complete sort of absence of any great charisma. If you had someone who was more charismatic, he could probably unseat the situation, which is frankly not very favourable towards the Tory Party at the moment. But their inability to sort of do that means that they're not going to do it. So I think you do need to have that sort of pizzazz to attract attention. But I think that in a case like hers, the reason she does have this sort of attractiveness, it's because she leads a country that is succeeding. She leads, she's leading a successful country. She's a stable person who has sort of managed to project this air of confidence and capability that other people sort of seem to flounder about with.
Isn't it interesting that we've been talking about the East Germany being a country left behind and therefore people out on the streets. Here is an East German woman who's actually managed to reinvent herself as a very successful answer to. One of the things I think about Merkel is that she's not always visibly on message or saying what all her spin doctors have told her to say. She actually seems to be responding as herself. And I think that's one of the problems that our politicians seem to have so often in other countries, that they constantly seem to be somehow manipulating the information rather than just saying, here's what I think.
Quentin Peel, Raphael Pantucci, thank you for telling us what you think. Just for now, we'll be back with you in just a moment to talk about Guantanamo Bay and a couple of other things.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Quentin Peel from Chatham House and Raffaello Pantucci from RUSI. It was one of President Barack Obama's first promises upon moving into the White House. Guantanamo Bay military prison would be closed within a year. 6 years on, it is still very much open after Obama faced fierce political opposition. He's now attempting to close it down via the back door by slowly releasing prisoners to the point where it's unaffordable to keep it open. Raffaello Pantucci, we saw prisoners recently being sent off to Uruguay. There are other prisoners that are going to be going off to other parts of the world, some being quietly released here and there, a couple of whispered apologies at times. Is this the way that it can be closed, or is this just slightly embarrassing for the US?
No, I think this is the way it's going to be closed. And I think when Obama came in, he signed the document, I think it was like the first decree he signed. He said, we will close this within a year. This is a stain on America's conscience, and how could we have done this? And it was so emblematic of the sort of war on terror and all the errors that were perceived to being made by the Bush administration. He thought, okay, by doing this, by getting rid of this lodestone, you'll sort of change the conversation. And then he discovered that, in fact, it's very difficult to actually do for a wide range of different reasons. For one thing, there's the politics domestically of releasing them back home. The other thing is getting them through the courts, getting them cleared to the point that they can be sent. And then where do you send them? You know, if you're going to send them in a lot of these places, you can't send them back to their countries of origin because they'll be persecuted horribly there. So you have to send them somewhere else. But then you have to persuade those countries to take them. And so you have to release the information to them and the intelligence and show them why this person is now not a risk and he's acceptable while this one is not. It's a very long and complicated process. And as you're doing this, you're constantly facing a changing political wind in Washington, where one day the Senate may vote, may be willing to support something, and then next day it may not because of other sort of political machinations. And so it was always, I think, going to be more of a drip feed process, frankly, like this. I think it was very ambitious for him to say, you know, I will close this in a year. And I think in a way that's probably residual hubris from his initial election campaign, where he was sort of saying, I am here to change the world.
Quentin Peel, was this a sort of a combination of bad politics in not being able to actually face down those Republicans, indeed some Democrats, who said, well, you know, you can't release them back to my district. You know, you'll make us a terrorist target here in Idaho or wherever it is. And also symbolic of how difficult it can actually be to do things rather than just to say things.
I think he did misread, perhaps, the sheer depth of the resistance to letting people like this straight back out again. The post 9/11 effect, which, I mean, really was such a massive trauma in the US. And it's been a real battle to turn that round. And I don't think we're near the end of that yet. So I think that was certainly a big problem for him. I think the tragedy of Guantanamo Bay is that it has been a terrible slur on actually America's reputation for upholding the principles of freedom and so on. I mean, the fact that there is no clear legal basis for any of this is a real problem. And that has damaged America, not just in the Muslim world, in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, but indeed in Europe too.
And Rafael Pantucci, you know, we're seeing that sort of the impact on America's reputation and the impact of Guantanamo with the ISIS propaganda videos. You know, what are they wearing, the hostages there? They're wearing the orange jumpsuits that, you know, that we saw from the original pictures in Guantanamo.
No, I think you're right. And it's clearly an image that, you know, is now seared into the sort of collective consciousness and will always be associated with Guantanamo, the sort of orange jumpsuit thing. So I think that that's an errata that really can't sort of be erased at this point. But I think what's going to be very interesting about this whole question is actually what's coming up, is because what you've seen in the releases to Uruguay and the releases to Kazakhstan recently was they're slowly being able to get rid of some of them, because there's a lot of guys there who frankly could have gone home quite a while ago. The question is, where were they going to go back to? And that was really the dilemma. And that's why we're seeing them going to these sorts of random countries. But when you get it down to people like, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the sort of architect of 9/11, what are they going to do with him? Because here you have a man who definitely was involved in something. They have a case that could work before a court, but how are they going to try him and where are they going to try him? And I think once you get down to that final group of, I would say, 20 or 30 people, it's going to be very curious what they're going to do with them, because there they really can't send them to other countries because no other country is going to take them, because these are proven people with long negative track records. But once we get down to that question, it's really going to be this question of how can they actually bring it to a close.
Okay, just finally, this was the day that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared that journalists in his country enjoy more freedom than anywhere in Europe. And what happened? Well, Dutch journalist Frederik Geerdink tweeted that her home in the Turkish city of Diyarbakir had been raided and she'd been taken into custody on charges stemming from propaganda for a terrorist organisation. Quentin Peel, Turkey, I mean, it seems like Turkey's long given up on joining the European Union, and the European Union's long given up on Turkey. Is this, does anyone have any influence outside of Turkey now on things like this, you know, unmistakable crackdown that's taking place against journalists?
I think not at the moment. I think that President Erdogan is in a position where he's not listening to anybody except those he wants to listen to. Having said that, there is a very real civil society that exists in Turkey, and it hasn't been completely destroyed or suppressed. And I think that if President Erdogan overplays his hand, he's going to see the backlash get bigger. This is a young population, a dynamic population, and they're not going to accept simply that they don't have civic rights.
And Rafael, I mean, that's the interesting point about this, isn't it? That it hasn't, you know, despite these crackdowns, and there have been many, it hasn't actually led to less opposition in Turkey or less voices. They may not have the, you know, they may not have the newspapers they want on, but, you know, journalists have been sacked, now have, you know, almost a million Twitter followers. So, yeah, in some ways they have a bigger audience than they did before.
I mean, I think it's, you know, the question here is Erdogan seems to be, you know, slowly clamping down and slowly sort of doing things in a distinct direction, but he seems to be doing it in a slightly, you know, in a relatively limited and still restrained fashion. This isn't, you know, as extreme as other governments where we've seen, where they're sort of mass arresting journalists and throwing them in jail and not, you know, revealing any the charges against them. We're seeing here a sort of attempt at booting people out of offices and trying to make their lives more difficult, which, you know, it's not an eradication. It's a sort of a gradual encroaching, let's say, on the civil space.
Rafael Pantucci and Quentin Peel, we'll leave it there. We were going to talk about China as well, but we just didn't have time. Thank you both for joining us here on Midori House. Lovely. That was great. Okay, and don't worry, second half's going to be great as well. We've got music with Nick Luscombe. We're also taking a look at the Chinese weekly papers, something that you'll hear on no other radio station anywhere in the world. And there's also an interview with Iceland's first billionaire. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
A suicide bomber's blown herself up inside a police station in Istanbul. It happened in an area popular with tourists, close to the Blue Mosque. Two officers were badly injured, and Istanbul's governor says the one has since died from their injuries. The bombing comes less than a week after a far-left group said it was behind a grenade attack on police near the prime minister's office in the city. There have been further sharp falls in the price of oil, dropping to levels that haven't been seen for more than 5 years. Brent crude dropped to just over $51 a barrel before recovering a little. In the US, crude oil prices have fallen far below $50. The parliament in Pakistan's passed a law setting up military courts to try terror suspects. It's part of a crackdown on insurgents that follows last month's attack at a school in Peshawar, in which more than 150 people died, nearly all of them children. And a new term begins today in the US Congress, with Republicans in control of both chambers for the first time in 8 years. The party won a majority in the Senate in last November's midterm elections. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. It's 2031 in Johannesburg, it's 1831 here in London. Now, two or three times a week here on Midori House, we delve into the new weekly news magazines in a certain part of the world. And today, we're heading to China. Patrick Bowler, a Hong Kong-based journalist with the South China Morning Post, leafed through the fresh Chinese news weeklies with Monocle's David Pleasant a little bit earlier.
So Southern Weekly is one of the most important weekly publications in China. It was it started in 1984 and is known for its investigative journalism. They have uncovered cases of social injustice, and they have documented corruption. And they're a very courageous weekly publication based in Guangzhou. And they have a New Year editorial where they talk about what they expect from the year in China. And that became a big problem 2 years ago when Xi Jinping rose to power. And they wrote an editorial in which they said, we hope that our constitutional rights will be guaranteed in this coming year. And the censors, of course, cut it. And there was an unprecedented strike at the newspaper. And even street protests outside the headquarters of the newspaper was something that's completely unheard of in China.
What kind of reaction has there been? I mean, what's the editorial focusing on? Their hands were tied in previous years. So how have editors reacted 2 years on?
So this year's editorial is interesting because 2 years ago they talked about the constitution and rights in the constitution. So last year, after they were censored, they were very careful not to mention the constitution. And this year, they mentioned the constitution. And they talk about courage, and they talk about they hope that the government will make bold choices in the future. So they're very carefully choosing their words, but they're also, you know, bringing back the same topics that they wanted in that they talked about in the past.
And particularly pertinent would be the protests that engulfed Hong Kong at the end of last year. I mean, what mention is there of those protests? What kind of line has the Southern Weekly taken?
Oh, there's no mention at all. They can't really report on it. The mainland media reports on the protests in Hong Kong were strictly following the party line. So they were saying these people were disrupting daily life in Hong Kong. There was no in-depth reporting on what motivated the protesters in Hong Kong. It just wouldn't be allowed.
Okay, and let's go on to another important weekly. Tell us about the next title that you have there in front of you.
Oh, so Caixin is a publication run by Hu Shuli, who is one of the leading journalists in China. And they have been, there's a weekly, it's a business weekly, and they have been on the forefront of uncovering corruption in China. They have been, they're pretty much a leading publication on corruption, cases of graft in China. And the last issue talked about Ling Jihua, the personal assistant of the last president of China, Hu Jintao, who is currently being investigated for graft.
And tell me, it seems like the authorities and the official media outlets in China for a long time have sort of invested quite a lot in this anti-corruption, anti-graft sort of showcase reporting and so on. Do you see that continuing with titles such as Cai Xin? Is it still something that is prominent?
Yes. And most of these, like with the report then on Lin Jihua, you can see that these newspapers have been given information, leaked information, personal information on these former senior leaders, which can only happen if someone provides this information to them. So as the corruption crackdown continues, I think the strategy will be the same. They will continue to leak information, also in an attempt to discredit these officials before they have stood trial. But also journalists use this information they get to show what's wrong in China and the lack of accountability of these officials.
And then can you tell us about the next story that you've chosen from Cai Xin, another controversy in China?
Yes. So two of the most prominent real estate investors in China, Pan Xiyi and Zhang Xin, there's a couple that's behind Soho China, one of the biggest real estate conglomerates in China, they have caused a lot of controversy by starting this endowment, which will pay for Chinese students to study at Harvard University and at Yale. And they have received a lot of criticism in China for doing this. They said, people have said, why are you not spending this money on Chinese universities? Don't you trust our education system? And are you just buying, your way into Harvard for your children? And so they have come out and given this interview to Cai Xin, talking about the philanthropy in China. And it's really important right now because, as Zhang Xin says, 2014 might have been the year in which philanthropy became, popular, a doable thing in China amongst China's richest. Two of the founders of Alibaba, Jack Ma and a co-founder, pledged to donate, I think it was a percentage of the Alibaba share equity to charity, and this is something that would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago.
That was Patrick Bowler of the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong talking to Monocle's David Pleasant. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll look at the highs and lows in the career of Iceland's first billionaire.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Do indeed tune into the Stack this Saturday, and indeed next Saturday, tune in for a special show which will be broadcast from Switzerland. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Throughout the Christmas and New Year season here on Monocle 24, we've sat down with a number of big names, such as chef Massimo Bottura and music icon Brian Eno, for a series of special one-on-one interview editions of The Briefing. Today, we'll look back to our chat with Icelandic businessman and entrepreneur Thor Björgólfsson. Thor is Iceland's first billionaire, and he's written a book about his experiences, Billions to Bust and Back, How I Made, Lost and Rebuilt a Fortune, and What I Learned on the Way. Very long subheading there. Thor sat down with Tom Edwards to explain the highs and lows of his career.
I think I've always had it in me. I mean, I've always been a guy who's wanted to have a job, make a buck, and keep busy. So, you know, from, you know, 10, 11 years old, just, you know, doing the paper routes of delivering, you know, the newspapers, to being a delivery boy, and then all kinds of stuff. And if I could trade with things, that was great. I became a comic book collector when I was a young man, and I started trading them.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because you got a loan from your dad to get some of your favorite comics, and that was kind of an early investment. Is that still in the portfolio now, or are they long gone?
No, funnily enough, they're still in the portfolio. You know, I had them and I kept them in a garage. It was about 1,000 to 1,500 of them, and then a young guy from my wife's family came to me and said, "I'm a collector as well." And said, "Fine, it's your, take it and keep them safe and take good care of them." He called me the other day and said, "Now I've gotten along and, you know, my children are 2 and 3 years old, but your boy is getting close to 10. Why don't you take back your collection and mine, and he takes care of it for the next 10 years?" I said, so it's now going between generations. So it's a good thing. So my son and I picked it, or the whole collection up 2 months ago.
And it's interesting because you write in the book, there's a proverb that you start one of the chapters with about family and about the strength that you can get, and to hear this story about, you know, these heirlooms, if you like, that are passing through. Family, very important. Is that one of the things that helped you to weather, you know, the crisis moments, the lower moments? Did you find that you could take a lot of strength from, you know, the people who are immediately around you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you there is strength in, you know, having somebody to lean on when you feel weak. There's also great advantage in having someone tell you the true story of how things are, because when things are tough, there's always a temptation to go look for scapegoats, be angry, start blaming people. It's good to have people in the family who said, "Well, take a second look and maybe you bear some of the blame yourself." And that's very healthy and beneficial to have. And just, you know, also when the night is darkest, you know, it's great to have lovely people you can share time with and relax.
Let's kind of chart a bit of a way through your career then. I like this notion of adventure capitalism. I think, you know, it's not a bad pun, and it also, I think, speaks to an attitude that you need to gain success, particularly in some pretty challenging markets. A lot of this for you was in the sort of, if you like, the slightly kind of lawless lands of you know, of Russia, this notion of the Wild East. Were you very aware that although there was a maybe a bit of a sort of a, you know, a menacing quality to that, there was also a great opportunity there?
Yeah, I mean, when I came there, you know, I out of the first group of people who went there, I was the youngest by far. And I saw the older guys looked around and said, "This is just horrible. We're not going to be staying here for a year. I mean, there's nothing in the shops. There's nothing to buy or see." And I thought to myself, "That's great. We have to make it all." So I just saw it as an opportunity. And I also felt this is a historic moment, you know. If for a young man to be here in this time of, you know, upheaval and change, this is a great place and time to kind of cut your teeth and learn. I thought it was a unique moment, and I felt really strongly that I wanted to participate in it.
Was it scary at all, though? Because, you know, a lot of people talk about the, you know, this sort of early gangster capitalism that was going on there. There were some pretty frightening people in positions of power. I think paths crossed with certain Mr. Putin at one stage. Was it a frightening time, or did you always feel like you could, you know, you could hold your own in that theater?
You know, looking back, it was frightening at times, but I would say that, you know, 95% of it was hard work and just the the boring slugging of going through monotonous problems every day and just going, you know, Russia would change on an instant. The currency might fall 25% in a day. You know, the whole electricity would go off the block for 2 days. It was just endless array of small problems. And these kind of gangster problems, when you take them, they may be 2% of the time. But when you look back, they stand out. But when you were there in the thick of it, they tended to kind of blend in with all the other stuff going on. And you said, well, this probably will fade away like everything else.
And I just wonder, as your career developed, you enjoyed more and more successes. And as the theatres of this changed and it became less this sort of, you know, frontiersman mentality in Russia, and it became more, you know, the boardrooms of big corporation, big banks all across Europe, globally. Mm. Were there lessons that you'd learned, though, do you think, in your earlier days, the more kind of street fighting business, that you could actually deploy very ably, you know, on those boardroom floors instead?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing which carried me very far in Russia was that, you know, keep an idea alive, believe in it, and don't listen to anybody who tells you differently. That's also part of being headstrong, young, but, you know, full of belief. That is also the kind of attitude I took in the boardrooms once we were there. And I got into a few tussles there as well with boards and CEOs, whether they're firing them or backing down or things like that. But I thought to myself, you know, I'm here to be a catalyst. I want to, you know, I want to bring these companies forwards. And all of them where I had a stake, I thought they could be better. And some of them, I managed to implement those changes. I wanted to make them grow and to be the catalyst. Some of them, it didn't work out. You know, they was too entrenched or things like that. For instance, in Finland when I retreated. So there was some of the kind of the drive that I had as a young man saying, don't take no for an answer. And just if you have belief in your idea, you thought it through, you know, just keep following the idea and never mind what happens.
There we are. Words of advice from Thor Bjørgolfsson from his new book, Billions to Bust and Back. He was talking to Tom Edwards.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Okay, almost at the end of the show. Before we go, time for a look at some of the best music tracks out this week, or at least sort of picked this week, by Nick Luscombe, one of our regular Monocle 24 experts. Nick, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, thank you.
We've got three tracks today. Let's start with Silk Roads. Tell us a bit about Silk Roads and then introduce this track.
Okay, well, Silk Roads, the greatest thing about them is the name, obviously, Silk Roads with R-H-O-D-E-S.
So, Roads, you know, the Greek Roads.
That's right, yeah. Yes. So I quite like the fact that they've spelt their name imaginatively. They're from Baltimore. They're signed to Stone's Throw. So in a way, that's pretty much all I need to know because I love that label. But this is a great record, a great album. And this is a track from it. The album's out actually next month. There's still a way to go. But it's very minimal. Yeah, have a listen to this. Silk Roads with The System.
Another sister,
Silk Roads with the system. Now, what I find interesting about this is they're not kids, are they? And yet this is their first album.
Yeah, that's right. I think they were, what's the story? I think they're basically session musicians playing on different bands and with different bands, all part of the Stone's Throw conglomerate. And I think they're on a bus together and they kind of started writing stuff together while they were just in their spare time. And yeah, and it's a beautiful album. It sounds really formed. And obviously there's shades of kind of Isaac Hayes and instrumentation, and Al Green, I guess, springs to mind, you know, but it sounds modern as well, you know.
Do you think there's something to be said for waiting until you're sort of a more mature age before you do your first album? Because let's face it, most artists that release one album, you know, only really have one great album in them.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
And yet, you know, for some, they do it when they're 19, and yeah, it might be, you know, said that it could be a bit better if it comes when you're in your 30s.
I think so. I think, I mean, when I make my first album, I'm not going to be 19, that's for sure. So, I'm going to, you know, I think, and I won't be disappointed. I'll only do one and that'll be it, and I'll move on and be happy. So, yeah, no, I think it's
no difficult second album syndrome.
Exactly.
That would definitely be my problem, second album. First would be easy. Yeah. Let's move on. Portico. Tell us about Portico.
Portico, yeah, used to be called the Portico Quartet. There's only three of them now because Nick Mulvey's gone solo. So they
didn't go to Portico Trio?
No, you would have thought so, wouldn't you?
But is it a bit like when S Club 7, when one left, they didn't go to S Club 6, they just went to S Club?
I'm pretty much sure that they followed that as the kind of key reason to call themselves Portico, yeah. But they're sounding great, very different, much more electronic. But they've got Jono McCleary, who's, I think, a bit of a, I think he's my favourite sort of British singer-songwriter, to be honest. His voice is great. He sings on this track, which is the new single called Bright Luck.
Portico there with Bright Luck. And Nick, while I was playing, we were just saying that Jono McCleary, who sings there, it's the voice sounds really familiar, but that may be just because he sounds a bit like James Blake.
Yeah, it's true. I reckon that Jono, as a songwriter, I think he's up there with James Blake, to be honest. I think his time will come. I think a lot of people recognise that. But yeah, I mean, Portico is sounding so different to the quartet when they're much more obviously jazz influenced. And they've been, the three of them are heading in a much more electronic direction, as you can tell from that track.
And where, you know, because often when one band member leaves, you know, I mean, often usually that means the end of the band. And then, you know, you'll reform with other people, you'll do something different. Are you sort of pleasantly surprised that they've gone off in a new direction and yet still seem to be doing as well, or sort of making as interesting music as they were before?
Well, they were sort of involved in this project called Circle Traps, I think they were called. And Circle Traps. And they were much more electronic. So they've always had that kind of thing going on within the band. And I think as individuals, they're all, well, they're pretty talented guys and they can work the way around real instruments and also kind of laptops. So I'm pleasantly surprised that the music is as good, you know, definitely.
Okay, let's end with a Japanese-based Buddhist priest.
Yeah, so this guy appeared in this film called Kanzeon, which came out a couple of years ago, which was all about religious sound in Japan, basically. Quite a beautiful film. And he appears in a scene where he's this hip-hop priest and goes around to these kind of old people's homes, kind of rapping and scratching, you know, but teaching Buddhism at the same time. Which is obviously quite unusual. But he's also pretty prolific in terms of his musical output as well. And this is a new track I got sent from him, which I just think is really interesting. It's you know, it's very jazzy. A lot of his stuff's much more sort of hip-hop driven. But yeah, here's a new one anyway from Japan. And it's called, I'm trying to think of the title actually. I can't actually read my own writing.
Harlem Water.
See, that's
I've,
you know,
I've
you're
typed
it
out, so I don't have to look at your own writing.
I've got this little scribble, yeah.
Tatumi featuring T2 with Harlem Water.
We'll be right back.
There we are. Tatumi featuring T2 with Harlem Water. Nick Luscombe, thanks for your three picks. If you have to choose one to take with you, I mean, obviously you take all of them with you because they're yours. Them, yeah. You brought them with us.
I'm going to go for Tatumi showing some love for Japan, I think. Yeah, and just their kind of love of Japanese kind of hip-hop and jazz fusion. There we are.
Okay, I'm taking Silk Road System. We'll leave Portico, although it was brilliant. Nick, thank you very much indeed. And that brings us to the end of today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to all our guests, but in particular, Quentin Peel and Raffaello Pantucci. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland and Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster. The studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next up, after the headlines, is our weekly design show, Section D, with Tom Morris. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.